Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we read Daniel chapter 6, where we revisit the ever-complex power triangle between king, people, and God. How do we make decisions about loyalty when the points of that triangle appear to be in tension? And to put a finer point on that question, there's a lion in a pit eagerly awaiting your response. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Bobby. How are you today?
I'm good, Amy. How are you?
I am doing all right. My household is coming out of something like 64 hours without power.
Oh, my goodness.
Significant power outage.
Are you everybody okay?
Everybody is okay. The refrigerator is sparkling clean, but we're fine.
Well, I'm glad that your power is back, and I'm glad that y'all can get back to normal now.
Yes, yes, and I'm also glad that I do not have to spend the night in a lion's pit.
Yeah, so much better to spend the night in the dark than in the there's no lions in your house. Yeah.
There's no lion's pit. There are incontinent dogs, but there are not. There are no lions.
Yeah, you hope that God will seal up their, not their mouths, but their behinds. Yes.
Yeah, my kids and I, when we woke up the first morning, I was like, now we get to play dog pee in the dark.
Oh,
like, you can't see anywhere, but you know somewhere.
Someplace you're going to step in a little puddle.
So, yeah, it's exciting. Yeah, yeah, yes. So we are in the book of Daniel.
Yeah.
The narrative lectionary gives us most of chapter 6, but not all of chapter 6.
Yeah.
And so we just decided to, you know, round up and do all of chapter 6. But before we start that, can you situate us a little bit in the book of Daniel?
So the story of Daniel is set right at the end of the exile in Babylon. So chapters 1 through 5 are given as taking place in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, the Babylonian kings, while the Jews are in exile in Babylon. Chapter 6, where we're picking up today, is set in the reign of a character that they call Darius the Mede, who never existed really, probably in reality, but seems to be maybe Darius the Persian, who is the third king of Persia. In any case, we're set right at the end of the Babylonian exile, and we're set in the diaspora. And so the book of Daniel, in some ways, wrestling with the question of what does it mean to be Jewish? What does it mean to be a person of faith living in a land where the laws of the empire, the laws of the kingdom, are not the Torah, right? And so how do can you succeed in the empire? How do you be obedient to God while also succeeding in the empire and those sorts of things?
So the versification in Daniel is different between texts that are between, I guess, the NRSV and the NJPS.
That's right, yeah. So the Christian tradition marks the beginning of the chapter one verse later than the Jewish tradition does.
So I'll start in what is verse 1 in the NJPS, which is the last verse of chapter 5. Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. It pleased Darius to appoint over the kingdom 120 satraps to be in charge of the whole kingdom. Over them were three ministers, one of them Daniel, to whom these satraps reported, in order that the king not be troubled. This man, Daniel, surpassed the other ministers and satraps by virtue of his extraordinary spirit, and the king considered setting him over the whole kingdom. The ministers and satraps looked for some fault in Daniel's conduct in matters of state, but they could find neither fault nor corruption, inasmuch as he was trustworthy and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Those men then said, "We are not going to find any fault with this Daniel unless we find something against him in connection with the laws of his God."
Yeah.
This setting reminds me so much of the Book of Esther.
Yeah, absolutely. a lot of folks read these stories together, and maybe you would add in the stories of Joseph in Genesis too, as
yes,
these kind of
yes,
tales
sure.
of court heroes, Jews mm-hmm. in the court of a foreign king.
Yes.
And all of those stories have some connection.
So one difference to me in the way that this initial story is laid out, the others in the court are looking for ways to find fault with Daniel.
Yeah.
They don't like that Daniel's rising to power, but Daniel doesn't really do anything that seems... You know, in Esther, Mordecai offends Haman.
Yeah.
Do you see in this text any... Can you, like, why are they trying to find fault in Daniel?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, the reason for the jealousy here is that Daniel's really good at his job. You know, he's...
Yeah.
You've got
good
these,
old-fashioned jealousy.
Yeah, no, I think that's it. So when the text starts, you've got these 120 satrapies, which are reporting to three... My translation says presidents, which I think is not a great translation, but I forget what your translation is.
Mine said ministers.
Ministers. I like that better, but it's ministers not in the sense of like,
yeah.
you know, Presbyterian minister, but in the sense of like the minister of the interior or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they each report to one of these ministers who then reports to the king. So the king doesn't have to deal with all the stuff. And then Daniel is super good at his job. And so the king wants to promote him to be the one between all the satraps and the king.
I really like the explicit note in this section of text that the king sets all this up so he won't be bothered.
Yeah.
Like, we're just going to call it. Yeah. I don't want to be bothered.
Yeah. And you see this all the way through with the king is like, he's kind of like a little bit he's easy to manipulate.
Yeah.
Because he's not that invested. A little bit like Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. He's not
yes.
that interested in the details of ruling a kingdom. He is more just interested in like being the king and having somebody else take care of all the stuff. And so he can be misled into things he doesn't actually want to do by his subordinates.
And indeed, that is what's about to happen.
Yeah.
Okay, so picking up in my verse 7, which is your verse
yes,
six?
My verse 6. Yeah.
Okay. Then these ministers and satraps came thronging in to the king and said to him, O King Darius, live forever. All the ministers of the kingdom, the prefects, satraps, companions, and governors are in agreement that a royal ban should be issued under sanction of an oath that whoever shall address a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, during the next 30 days shall be thrown into a lion's den. So issue the ban, O king, and put it in writing so that it be unalterable as a law of the Medes and Persians that may not be abrogated. Thereupon King Darius put the ban in writing.
It's really interesting in this section of text. Like, I mean, I just read this as like a stroking of the king's ego, right? Like, there's no good reason given for this. Like, hey, we all got together and said, let's just make sure nobody worships anything except the king.
For 30 days.
For 30 days, yeah.
that to me is the funniest part of it. It's like, yeah. Let's just put in a 30-day checkpoint here to make sure nobody is doing anything that might offend you.
It's like celebrate the king month or something. Like it's like your birthday month, but...
It is.
Yeah.
It is. It's king's ego month.
But it's kind of an interesting move that the officials have made to say, like, they kind of get that the king, and I mean, maybe this is a comment on the nature of kings, according to the book of Daniel, is they like to have their egos stroked. And so,
it certainly is part of the other narratives that we have of, you know, the Jew becoming successful in the foreign court, is the ego of the king is like its own character in the room.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, I guess this story doesn't tell us one way or the other, but the people who come in tell the king that there's been this widespread agreement among all the other leaders that this is how it ought to go. And if that is true, we don't have that part of this in the story. I mean, I read that as they're coming in and just claiming that, you know, all the prefects and the satraps and the companions and the governors are all in agreement.
Yeah, so you get in verse 4 in the NRSV, the presidents and the satraps tried to find grounds for complaint against Daniel. So you at least get the notion that these two minister guys have consulted the 120. But the counselors and governors, like, there's nothing in the text that suggests, you're right, that those have been consulted at all. And so they're just kind of saying the whole government is in agreement, when in fact, 120 two people. It's a lot of people, but
yeah.
Yeah. But they are speaking on behalf of a nation which they have not actually consulted.
And it's interesting to me, again, this idea that we saw in Esther, that once the king puts something in writing, it cannot be undone.
Yeah.
You know, that once it's in writing, it's like the power is newly located outside the king. The king has power in the moment that they put it in writing. But they actually ultimately lose power by doing that. I don't think we have any evidence that indicates that this was the way things worked in these kingdoms.
No, it's a terrible way. It's a terrible idea to be like, hey, once you write this thing down, you can never change it.
You can never change it.
Yeah, it's a terrible idea. But it's a very nice plot technique.
It is a fantastic plot technique. Yeah. Yes, that is true. So then picking up in my verse 11, your verse 10. When Daniel learned that it had been put in writing, he went to his house, in whose upper chamber he had had windows made facing Jerusalem. And three times a day he knelt down, prayed, and made confession to his God, as he had always done. Then those men came thronging in and found Daniel petitioning his God in supplication. Then they approached the king and reminded him of the royal ban. Did you not put in writing a ban that whoever addresses a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, during the next 30 days shall be thrown into a lion's den? The king said in reply, the order stands firm as a law of the Medes and the Persians that may not be abrogated. Thereupon they said to the king, Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, pays no heed to you, O king, or to the ban that you put in writing. Three times a day he offers his petitions to his God. So we open with this scene of a very pious Daniel.
Yeah.
Who, it says, has had a chamber in his house. He's had windows put in to face Jerusalem. Yeah. The text goes out of its way to tell you that it's not that the windows were just there. He had the windows put in, and he prays three times a day, and he's about to pray right now.
That's really interesting. The NRSV's translation is just his house, which had windows in its upper room. And so there's sort of a, like the translators, some of the translators are giving Daniel slightly more or less sort of agency in the creation of those upper rooms. I mean, in the creation of those windows in the upper room. Mm-hmm. But I think it's interesting that, like, it starts out, you know, in the first line here, Daniel knew that this document existed. And he went to his window and he prayed. And so when you think about Daniel's agency, like the kind of least direct way to think of Daniel is he knew that there was a thing and he did his usual practice anyway.
Right.
Knowing that somebody might see him and he was seen. You could also read this as a more forward thing from Daniel where he knew it had been signed. So he flung open his windows and prayed. Kind of intentionally to be
so, like,
seen.
Flagrantly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you prefer one of those ways of thinking about it?
You know, I had a similar question for you, whether we thought that his prayer was in response to having read this, or whether he read it and then continued his regular practice. Although, the way that you asked the question raises another question for me, which is, how did the... In my translation, it looks like the men came thronging in and found Daniel petitioning his God in supplication.
Yeah.
So I picture these bunch of fools like running into his house, looking at running upstairs in his house, looking at him pray. They don't say anything and they run back out, which is a very strange scene.
A couple of things there. One is, at the end of my verse 10, he prayed just as he had done previously. And so this seems to be not something that Daniel's starting today because he knows of the thing, but something that Daniel's been doing all along, and he's just continuing to do his practice. My assumption has been that because Daniel has a window and he prays at the window, that people knew he did this, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, so part of the trap that these officials have laid for him is that they know this is his practice. And so they're testing him to see whether he's going to keep doing his practice. And in fact, he does. And my thought about that is that the men kind of were out there looking to see what he would do. And then when they saw him starting to pray, and they kind of bust in, they say, ha ha, we caught you, Daniel.
Right. And they don't seem to have any interaction with him, or that the text doesn't record.
They throng in, they throng right back out.
Right. Daniel doesn't say anything.
Take a pic with their phone.
Yeah, exactly. And then they go back to the king.
Yeah.
And strategically, yes, before they report what they've seen, they get the king to re-articulate this law, even though they've already said that the law can't be abrogated.
And so in verse 13, Daniel, dun dun dun, and then he's described as one of the exiles from Judah, which to me is a really interesting way of describing him. What did you think about that?
I mean, it just seems to me another, like, a moment where they're going out of their way to, I mean, the text is going out of its way both to sort of underscore that he's one of us from the perspective of the author, but it also has these leaders of the Persian kingdom maybe going out of their way to underscore that he's not Persian, not Mede.
Yeah.
You know, he's an outsider. Although the king doesn't seem to care about that particularly.
I think that's right. And so they're marking him as an outsider who does not belong among us. And he is not loyal to you, which is in fact not true, but they're using this sort of, he's praying to his own God as a sign that he is not loyal to the king, or at least not willing to be solely loyal to the king, I suppose, for 30 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's this kind of like separation based on either ethnicity or religious persuasion, or maybe some combination of those two things.
Okay. So I am in my verse 15, your verse 14. Upon hearing that, the king was very disturbed, and he set his heart upon saving Daniel, and until the sun set, made every effort to rescue him. Then those men came thronging into the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that any ban that the king issues under sanction of oath is unalterable. By the king's order, Daniel was then brought and thrown into the lion's den. The king spoke to Daniel and said, Your God, whom you serve so regularly, will deliver you. A rock was brought and placed over the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his signet and with the signet of his nobles, so that nothing might be altered concerning Daniel."
I'm really drawn to this thronging word now that you've pointed it out to me. And one of the things, you know, like, in terms of, like, who are you imagining? If it was just these other two ministers, the two presidents, like they would be unable to throng because there's only two of them.
That's right.
So I think we're supposed to imagine 122 people, like all like piling into all these rooms, like all the satraps and these two ministers. So they're just thronging it around together.
It is really interesting to think about what kind of numbers you need, like what kind of crowd you need to get all whipped up in order for them to be able to throng. Because I think just as we, you know, mentioned briefly the idea that the king's ego is its own character in these stories, there's something about the crowd mentality and that once the crowd is whipped up, that's a difficult thing to work against.
It's interesting to me the degree to which this text is sort of like it's trying to like exonerate the king a little bit and say this is not really the king's fault.
Yeah.
And it is also in some way, I think, saying like you might be in danger in an empire, even if the ruling authority is actually friendly to you. You can get yourself into trouble if other people that are less powerful, but maybe more shrewd about how they exercise the power that they do have.
That's a really good point. That your safety within the kingdom is not only based on your relationship with the singular leader.
Yeah.
The power is never distributed that way.
Yeah, so here we have Daniel being thrown into a pit where there are lions, and then the lions are sealed up with a stone. Mm-hmm. And somehow there's a seal actually placed on there with signets and everything. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a strange, like, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of, like, the beast in Jabba the Hutt's Katita or whatever that thing was in Return of the Jedi, where there's just that beast down there and like it toss people down into the pit and then release the beasts. Uh-huh. And so like the image is just that they've got this like pit of lions like waiting around for somebody to eat. Is that how you kind of read it?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of picture this pit, you know, under the castle. I'm not actually sure right now why that's what I pictured, sort of I guess a dungeon like space. And the idea of sealing it with a signet ring again is just fascinating. Like it's such a strange you must follow the letter of the law
and it's sealed system. With his own ring and also the rings of his lords, and so there's this sense that even if the king wanted to go break the seal and pull Daniel out, like he can't do it. It's like you got to have two keys in order to like fire the missile or whatever. It's kind of a similar idea there.
Okay, so moving on to my verse 19, your verse 18. The king then went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and his sleep fled from him. Then, at the first light of dawn, the king arose and rushed to the lion's den. As he approached the den, he cried to Daniel in a mournful voice. The king said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, was the God whom you served so regularly able to deliver you from the lions?" Daniel then talked with the king. "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel who shut the mouths of the lions so that they did not injure me, inasmuch as I was found innocent by him. Nor have I, O king, done you any injury." The king was very glad and ordered Daniel to be brought up out of the den. Daniel was brought up out of the den, and no injury was found on him, for he had trusted in his God. Then, by the order of the king, those men who had slandered Daniel were brought, and together with their children and wives were thrown into the lion's den. They had hardly reached the bottom of the den when the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Okay, so the king has a very distressed night. As soon as it's morning, he rushes down to the den and says in this mournful, like, hopeful voice,
"Yeah,
are you okay?" But he doesn't just say, "Are you okay?"
Yeah.
Like, he specifically refers, things become pretty pious from here on out,
yeah,
for the king.
Yeah.
What do you make of his interaction with Daniel?
Like, I just love the image of the king. You know, this is the king of Media and Persia, and he is up all night because Daniel's in the lion's den, and he's fasting and, you know, refusing food. Interestingly, the not eating is sort of paralleling what he hopes the lions are also like. Maybe if I fast, maybe the lions will fast too, maybe. So that the servant of the living God to me is the most interesting line there. Because, like, did your God save you is a totally reasonable thing for someone who is not a God worshiper to ask. But to refer to Daniel's God as the living God,
it's a theological statement.
It is. And he does not yet know. Like, it's one thing to be like, "Hey, your God saved you, and so your God must be the living God." But here it's like, "Hey, you servant of the living God, did your God save you?"
Yeah.
What do you make of this? Is the king having kind of a conversion experience here?
I mean, I guess looking at his sort of the last 24 hours for the king and how he seems to go from despair, maybe that's too dramatic a word, but at realizing the harm he himself has caused to realizing the only way Daniel is getting out of this is with God's help.
Yeah.
And then staying up all night, it does read a little bit like a conversion experience, like a realization that while he is the king and has lots of power, there are things he cannot control.
Yeah.
And in this case, he's the one who set himself up for that, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, the power is no longer his.
Yep.
So it, I mean, it does kind of read like a conversion experience.
I love that way of saying that. The king realizes the contingency of his own power, but God's power is not contingent on anything.
Yeah.
God has power just because God is God, where the king realizes that he is limited in his own capacity to affect outcomes.
And then I am somewhat equally taken by the fact that Daniel doesn't respond by saying, "It's your lucky day, king."
Yeah.
Yes, God did. See, it's both of our lucky days, you know? He starts by saying, "O king, live forever."
Yeah.
And then says, "Yes, you know, God has saved me, and I have not done you any injury." Like, we're good.
Yeah.
We're good, Darius.
I would be so mad if somebody threw me in a lion's den. Oh my God. Yeah, like, that might be the end of it for our relationship if you ever threw me into a lion's den.
No more satrap jobs for you.
Yeah. Daniel is very gracious. And I mean, he's acknowledging, it seems like, in some kind of a way that the king really was powerless to save him. Even though the king could have, had the king been more shrewd, the king could have avoided this entire situation.
Mm-hmm.
But Daniel seems, like the text seems, to be blaming the, you know, the satraps and the ministers, and not putting blame directly on the king. Or maybe Daniel's just trying to preserve his, like, his position in the kingdom by saying,
"Well,
like, hey,
and I mean, there could, practically speaking, be some concern that once they've moved through this terrifying potential disaster, that the king will feel the hit on his ego, you know, and somehow holds Daniel responsible for it. You know,
that's interesting.
That when the king's ego is harmed, nobody nobody benefits.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's hard to know what exactly Daniel's thinking here, but he really goes out of his way to tell the king, nothing bad has happened to you.
Yeah.
You have not been diminished by this experience,
yeah,
which is a really funny priority at this moment when he's still in the den with the lion.
That's really, they could have at least like thrown him a rope before.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we have this interesting, just little side note at the end about how the king throws all these other guys and their entire families in with the lions.
I mean, in some ways, I sort of feel like, I mean, this is brutal, obviously, but we're in an ancient text. And so part of me thinks like, yeah, those two guys probably did deserve to be punished in some way. And maybe like punishing them with the thing that they tried to do to someone else, maybe that's not such a bad thing. But this sort of familial punishment seems really harsh to me.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know what to do with it other than to say this is...
Other than to name it and say this, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It does remind you, like, we've been talking about parallels to the Book of Esther, which also ends with the, like, the death of, like, lots of people who are perceived as enemies. Mm-hmm. I don't know as a reader of this text if the, you know, if the author has in mind that we would think, oh, that's a terrible thing, or if we would think, like, haha, your family's mm-hmm. got eaten by lions. Mm-hmm. I think we're maybe supposed to celebrate a little bit.
Yeah, I think it might be haha. Yeah. Yeah.
Like the text imagines that we're going to be happy about that.
It's a revenge fantasy.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I find it interesting, too, that the quote-unquote crime of these men is that they slandered Daniel.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if I would... I mean, I think their crime was that they tricked the king.
That's interesting.
But the intention of punishing Daniel, they didn't actually slander Daniel. I mean, they pointed out what Daniel did, but in a tricky way.
It's interesting that... So what they have said about him... I had to go back to verse 13 now. What they said to the king was, Daniel pays no attention to you or to the interdict you have signed. And so yes... They have tricked the king, and what they have done is they have said, this rule that we're asking you to make, if somebody disobeys it, it means they pay no attention to you. Whereas what Daniel actually does is pay, like, clear attention to the king and also attention to God. He sees no conflict between these two things.
Yes.
And the men have created an artificial conflict and then accused Daniel of disloyalty to the king based on his religious practice. So they created this like false dichotomy and then accused Daniel, which is not exactly the same thing as slander, but it is a little bit like they tried to rile the king up into thinking Daniel was doing something he didn't do.
Yeah, that's fair. So this last little section, my verse 26 through verse 25. Then King Darius wrote to all peoples and nations of every language that inhabit the earth, may your well-being abound. I have hereby given an order that throughout my royal domain, men must tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God who endures forever. His kingdom is indestructible, and his dominion is to the end of time. He delivers and saves and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. For he delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Thus Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and during the reign of Cyrus the Persian. This is a big statement.
It's huge. Yeah.
Things escalated quickly in the faith of King Darius.
Yes.
Okay, so my two questions are sort of, what do you make of that?
Yeah.
Which is just sort of a general bland question. And is this a happy ending to the story? Do you think this is a happy ending?
So this is kind of a trope in the Book of Daniel, which occurs at the end of chapters 2 and 4. Like, the king also has sort of this sort of conversion experience. And in chapter 3, there's a proclamation made that you can't blaspheme against the God of the Jews. And so, I mean, in one sense, I think what's happening here is this text, which is kind of imagining, like, what does it mean to be a faithful Jewish person in the diaspora? It's sort of imagining that eventually the kingdoms themselves are going to be converted, mm-hmm. and that's this mm-hmm. kind of like, mm-hmm. eventually our God is going to triumph over these foreign powers by way of conversion. So everybody's like, God's going to become the universal God. The fact that the king can recognize the power that Daniel's God has had here in saving Daniel's life and recognize that as true and mm-hmm. meaningful, I think that's a really beautiful idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, like, I think I know what you mean by asking whether this is a happy ending, but just the way you asked that question makes me really curious about what you're thinking. So instead of giving you an answer, I want to ask you what you think about that.
You know, as you were saying, the idea that all peoples can only believe in one God, or should only believe in one God, is a sort of Jewish imposition on the Persian worldview in this story. Yeah. Like, that wasn't really a Persian issue, that was a Jewish issue. Yeah. So they're imagining, what if the Persians had that issue?
Yeah.
And then how would this, you know, work out in that story?
Because you could imagine an alternate ending in which what happened here is the Persian king recognizes the power of Daniel's God and says everyone ought to be respectful of yeah. the Jewish right to worship the Jewish God. Mm-hmm. But y'all keep on keeping your own religious practice. Like, you don't have to convert, just be embracing of other folks. Yeah, mm-hmm. I can definitely, like, I understand why the text ends this way.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, a Jewish text written to a Jewish people living in a land living that is at that not time. Jewish.
Yes, I understand how it fits into the story.
But I do take your point that, like, you could imagine other alternate endings that might be more embracing of multiculturalism or something.
So, thankfully, being thrown into a lion's den is not currently
no.
on the table. So, hopefully. We don't need to have...
One never quite knows in this day and time where we might be headed.
But... Also a good point.
Yeah.
So, where would you take the message of this story for today?
With this text, we are moving into the Christian season of Advent, which is the season of waiting that anticipates the birth of Jesus, which is going to come here in a few weeks. And also anticipating the sort of the return of Jesus, which in the Christian tradition, you know, we believe that the Messiah is yet to come again. And so this text, Daniel 6, is the first of four Sundays, four texts leading up to sort of both of those things. It's leading us up to Christmas. And so, you know, I think the message of this text, whether you read it in that context or not, in my mind is something about that there is a call in this text to be true to one's own religious convictions mm-hmm. in the face of authorities that may be hostile in the case of the satraps and the officials, or may just be a little bit indifferent or manipulable in mm-hmm. the case of the king. And it is to say, one should continue practicing the practices of your religious faith, even when they come into conflict with the rules and laws that have been passed in the land in which you currently reside. So it's this sense of, like, the land in which we reside, no matter what it is, in this case, it's Persia, but I think contemporarily we could say the ruling authorities of this time are not the ruling authorities of the faith. And when those two come into conflict, that the person of faith's first loyalty is to God, not to the governmental structures. Mm-hmm. And so that creates tension from time to time. It could be about prayer practice, but it could also be about practices of justice and mercy and who do we stand up for and look out for. And when the government passes laws that oppress people that we believe that we are meant to protect, mm-hmm. and when the government oppresses the widow, the orphan, and the stranger, to use the language of Deuteronomy, like, people of faith, our job is to stand up for and protect those people, because that's what religious faith in both the Jewish and Christian traditions calls us to. In the context of Advent, I think this is a text about waiting, realizing that the fullness of God's kingdom is yet to come. And so in the meantime, we might well find ourselves in a metaphorical lion's den situation where it would be easier to give up our faith practices than to live them out. And this call is to be faithful even in the face of the lions, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a reminder that there is a morning that comes after the night in the lion's den, and that the call of faith is to trust that God will see us through that period.
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful. And I want to add one point of nuance to it that actually I learned from you the last time we studied the New Testament together, which is, so I think your reading is wonderful and true. And I think that if one gave a sloppier read of this text, one could believe that God saves people who are faithful and performs miraculous interventions for them. And so you can tell who's faithful mm. by the relative presence or absence of miraculous safety
yeah.
that you see in their life. And you can rely on it yourself. And you can, you know, that again, this is why it feels like a children's story.
Yeah.
The fact that that God's protection plays out so concretely
yeah.
for Daniel. Whereas when we were reading the gospel last year, you pointed out numerous times, quite rightly, that there is danger in this path, and you kind of have to be okay
yeah.
with that risk, you know, and there's something bigger that you're working towards.
Yeah.
And so I think that's actually a really great nuance to add to the way we think about God's miraculous interventions and what they may or may not look like for the individual.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. So it might be the case that some of us get thrown into a lion's den and actually get eaten by those lions. Like, that's the risk that one has to be willing to take.
But that doesn't undo what you said, that you're be confident of your truth and live in your truth.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I love that. What do you see when you read this text?
I think I'm tossing around a lot that sort of idea of I'm drawn really to the king's experience and how he started from this position of great power and ego and is sort of brought to his knees, realizing how little power he has and what a quick turnaround that was for him to invest all of this authority in the God of Israel. And I'm just thinking about the ways in which that can play out in our own lives, particularly when there are people who are imbued by society with a lot of power,
yeah,
and then have some experience of powerlessness, how that can lead to a sort of conversion experience like that.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, I don't have an answer to this question yet, but I'm wondering how that experience might play out differently for people who start out without all that power in the first place. I'm just thinking a lot about the power dynamics between the king and God, almost taking Daniel out of the equation.
Yeah.
And I didn't start thinking about that until we started talking about the text. So I don't have a neat period to put at the end of that sentence, but that's what I'm chewing on.
Yeah, I love that. Like, one of the things I was thinking as I was preparing for this is not really a story about Daniel. This is really a story about the relative power of God and the king and these sort of manipulative political leaders. Like, Daniel does some things, but Daniel's main thing he does is he prays.
Right.
But the center of the story, like, even when Daniel is in the lion's den, like, we're not with Daniel in the lion's den. We're with the king while Daniel's in the lion's
den.
That's
right. That's exactly right. We don't hear anything about what Daniel thinks or feels really throughout this whole thing. And he is just steady as can be. He stays the course.
Yeah.
And it's how everyone else responds to his staying the course.
Yeah. That's a really nice insight. I need to ponder that some more, but I think there's a lot. I think there's a lot there.
Well, we have survived the lion's pit.
We have, yeah.
From the comfort of our own homes, anyway.
Next week, we're in Joel chapter 2. The narrative lectionary, I think, is just verses 12, 13, 28, and 29.
Well, I look forward to that conversation, and I hope that you all have a great week.
Thanks, Amy. I'll see you next time.
Bye. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We're grateful to all our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois, and to our newest supporter, Mark Hanna.
Join us again next week when we'll be discussing Joel chapter 2. Until then, keep on digging.